Ready to soundtrack your summer? With Red Bull Summer All Day Play, you choose a playlist that fits your summer vibe the best. Are you a festival fanatic, a deep end DJ, a road dog, or a trail mixer? Just add a song to your chosen playlist and put your summer on track. Red Bull Summer All Day Play. Red Bull gives you wings. Visit redbull.com/brightsummerahead to learn more. See you this summer.
I'm Ariana Brocious.
And I'm Kushan Avidar.
And this is Climate One.
Hey, Ariana, could we start today just by taking a deep breath?
Sure. Ready? In.
It feels good.
Yeah, it does feel good, especially when you stop and think about it.
And what we're really talking about today is breathing. A lot of us do it without really thinking about what might be in the air we pull into our lungs. It's kind of like climate. We may not think much about it until something significant happens, like flood or a wildfire.
Yeah, I see where you're going here. Both air pollution and climate-disrupting emissions can be hard to visualize until the impacts become really apparent.
Exactly. And today, we're going to be talking about the connection between air pollution and human-caused climate disruption. I think it's an important connection to make. Air pollution from burning fossil fuels causes millions of premature deaths every year. So reducing the amount of fossil fuel use wouldn't just make for a healthier climate, it would really save millions of lives around the world.
Yeah, it's also important to talk about air pollution because talking about climate disruption has become so politically fraught. But I think mostly everyone can agree that air pollution is something we should try to prevent. I mean, we all want clean air.
Absolutely. You know, I like to run a lot. And lately, I've had to stop running outside and go indoors because the air pollution in New York City is rough with the wildfires in Canada. I mean, I can really feel it in the lungs if I run in bad air.
And you're a young guy. A lot of people, especially older adults and young kids, are even more vulnerable to bad air. A couple years ago, my 5-year-old spent a week in the hospital for what turned out to be asthma and some other respiratory distress, and it was an incredibly scary experience. So I've become much more attuned to the local air quality.
Yeah, I can't imagine how difficult that must have been. And, you know, our first guest also had that experience, and unfortunately, it continued to get worse. Rosamond Adu Kissi Debra lost her daughter, Ella Roberta, to a severe asthma attack in 2013. Ella was only 9 years old.
I never tire of talking about her, and I feel it's a privilege for me to talk to your listeners in America. And the reason why I say that is not because she's no longer here. In her short lifetime, she died when she was 9. I only told her off once, like severely, because she had stolen someone's soccer cards because Ella was obsessed with soccer. But generally, the reason why I bring this up is I sometimes have to remind myself, was she that good? And the answer is, yes, she was. She was a big sports fan, so she was always on wheels, so cycling, skateboarding, roller skating. She was a dancer and she did a bit of acting, singing, but I'm not going to lie, the voice wasn't great. Ella could play, no. See, I don't glamorize that. Ella could play, before she died at 9, about 12 instruments. So she knew her stuff.
Can you take me back to the day when you realized there was a problem?
Well, I wasn't sure at first. So the symptoms looked like her having a cold, a severe cold. So here, took her to the doctors, got her some antibiotics. But then she developed this cough. And the cough didn't go away. And they gave her stronger antibiotics. But the second time, they were like, let us refer you to the hospital. By the way, up until this point, she had never been to a hospital with her breathing. You need to remember.
And she was like 7 at the time? How old?
No,
was she
was 6 years and 9 months. So
okay.
This was October, and she turned 7 in January. Mm-hmm. And when you look at her record up until that point, the previous year, there was one where she'd had a virus, but she was a child. No one's going to be worried about one virus in 1 year. So there was nothing that pointed out what was about to happen. So the cough wasn't great, but also she gave her a blue inhaler to help when she was coughing. Still, I'm pretty hardcore because I teach in a school, maybe high school, you guys call it. My students are 14, 15, 16. So I'm not about to sweat when my daughter has got a cough.
Yeah. But it started getting worse.
It did get worse.
Like, what was her life like from then on in her last couple of years?
When I now think about it, because you can now look back, she was never 100% the same. She wasn't always having coughing and hypoxic seizures. Hypoxic seizures are to do with lack of oxygen. Not all the time. So during the Olympic Games, for some reason, she was fine. And also she began to learn when these attacks were going to come on. When it first started, even she wasn't aware of it. So it must have taken her by surprise. But as time goes on, sometimes she'll start coughing and she could probably see the panic in my eyes. And she would wave her finger that, no, I'm fine. I might be coughing, but I'm fine. Whereas if she was coughing, then she clang on to me. Then I thought, wow, we're in trouble here.
Tell me about your side of it too, then. What was your life like in those years?
Horrendous. I'm not going to lie. Horrendous. I don't think I will ever truly recover. And there's a very good reason for that. Because they had to eventually train me in the hospital. Because if she collapsed, you're not going to have an ambulance on your doorstep within 2-3 minutes. That's not how these things
work.
So I had to learn to resuscitate her and at least for her to be breathing. I am never going to get over it. Number one, I'm not going to get over her dying and also the manner she died as well. And I still feel that thing whereby I wanted to save her. But now that I'm talking to you 12 years on, it was going to be impossible. How many times can you resuscitate someone, let alone a child? I can now look back and see things, but when you're in the middle of it and you've never dealt with anything like that, and you have to be strong for your child as well. So even if I was panicking, and when people flatline, the last thing that goes is their hearing. So when I figured that out, it was to remain as calm as possible.
Wow.
Because I think her first one, when it happened, obviously I was shocked. She went blue. And I thought she died and I was screaming. Then when she came around, she went, why were you screaming? And I was like, you could hear me. She was like, yeah, of course I could hear you. So from that moment on, it didn't matter how I was feeling. I was going to remain calm. What you don't want when you're a child and you're struggling to breathe and you think you're dying, you don't need your mother as well screaming around. Seriously, that's not cool. But it was a lot to hold in. But for her sake, and this was always about her. I mean, I was her mother, but I wasn't going through it.
Well, you were going through sharing it and providing
a different kind of emotion.
And providing the love that you could.
Well, one of the things, when she always came around, I was always the first person she would call. Mm. So that was also, the medics would say, okay, she's coming back now. When she would say the word, mom.
So let's go to a difficult part of the story, but also the aftermath of it. So in 2013, your daughter, Ella Roberta, died from a severe asthma attack. She was 9.
Correct.
Ella's story led to a historic legal precedent when she became the first person globally to have air pollution listed as a cause of death on her death certificate.
Yeah, let me explain that. So when she became ill, I was a teacher, and you knew either a child was born with something or, but how she was so ill, I was always a bit like, this is really strange, because she hadn't previously been ill up until these things happened.
She was singing to Justin Timberlake and learning all the instruments, yeah.
Yeah, all that kind of stuff. So I remember at the child death review, I begged them to leave the case open. I wasn't sure how. Because actually, in court, it was the only time, because the doctors never knew really what was wrong with her. But in court, the first time round, they thought Ella's, those horrendous hypoxic seizures had something to do with the air. Now, we can sit here now and go air pollution. But if someone says, oh, your seizures are to do with something in the air, they might as well not tell you anything. Because something in the, what is something in the air? And the doctors were a bit like, we don't want you to go down this rabbit hole again. You've been through enough.
You know, it took you 7 years to get the system to make that designation of air pollution as a cause of death.
It really did.
Why was it so important you to push the system to recognize that?
Well, we had to find out. And I have to give credit to her lawyer, who found out that every time she was having these coughing seizures was when there was a spike in air pollution. That was her lawyer that worked that out.
Wow.
That was, I have to give her credit. She went to hospital about 28 to 30 times, and there was a correlation. There was only one episode that had nothing to do with the high air pollution. But yeah. I knew, because what we'd been through, that wasn't going to be enough. Now, luckily for me, when I'd gone up to see the coroner's officer, I don't know whether I was watching too many X-Files at the time or not, but I'd got her to take samples from Ella's body. So they were there. So when our expert came in, I realized that 28 out of the 29 times, there was a spike in air pollution. But I knew I wanted a bit more than that because we'd been for this test and that. So he went to speak to the senior pathologist who examined her when she died. And it was underneath the microscope. That's when they saw the PM2.5 and PM1 in her body.
So that led to the coroner ruling that, quote,
yes,
air pollution was a significant contributory factor to both the induction and exacerbation of her asthma.
Yeah.
Let me ask you, how did you feel when you received that ruling?
Well, it was devastating. This is what he said, quote, unquote, if it wasn't for the pollution near where we lived, this is what he said in court, not only would Ella not have got asthma at all, she wouldn't have died on that fatal night, because on the night she died, then it was at its highest. So he was very, very clear. Without the pollution, she would not have even got asthma in the first place.
Wow.
But I think the other thing I was shocked at is something that I thought, oh, this was just my daughter. Not when I was reading those studies. No, it told me this was everywhere. And I think that I'm still quite shocked. Look, the reason why I'm shocked, today in 2025, on the 19th of June, the same expert witness, again, has continued to do research. And he now says there are 500 people dying every week prematurely. So one of the things I need to make clear, in the area where we live, there is a lot of children with asthma, and it's higher than the national average. So if it wasn't Ella, it was always going to be someone else.
Of course.
We're still in exactly the same house that my daughter lived in. And there are many reasons for that, actually. And kind people have asked us over the years, why don't you move? And, you know, firstly, the road which we live on is very small. So we know there's about maybe 10 houses. Mm-hmm. So we know everyone. And I think, yeah, we can get a house somewhere else, but it's never going to have the memories that we have with my late daughter here.
Yeah.
And I think also it was really tricky because when she first passed away, the community really supported my twins, who were only 5 at the time. So yeah, to move away will be huge. So one of the things I always say to people is we shouldn't have to move. They should sort out the traffic, really.
What do you hope your experience might mean for other families facing similar pollution impacts?
We have managed to raise awareness. A lot more people, due to Ella dying, know about this. There's even a statue in our local park. There's a statue of her. But air pollution now is linked to 700 illnesses, diseases. It literally impacts every organ in our body. The most vulnerable, as we've discussed, are children and the elderly. And I think I take my time to explain to people. The reason is we breathe 11,000 liters of air every day. Children, 14,000 liters. And if you think we are breathing in things that you can't see with the naked eye, and they're very toxic. So some parts of London are similar to passive smoking, at least 12 cigarettes.
Wow. We're talking about pollutants in the air. I think it's a good moment to connect this to climate change then. So how do you see the connection between air quality and climate change? Like, why should climate advocates care more about air pollution?
Well, if you took air pollution seriously and you cleaned up the air, you will be improving the climate as well.
So before Ella got sick, you never wanted to be an anti-pollution campaigner.
No, I worked in a high school. My thing was getting students to pass their exams to go into university and things like that. That's what I am trained to do. I mean, it's definitely helped because I talk for a living now, but I was always talking as a teacher. So no, I didn't know anything about it. And nor did the doctors who were seeing us. We thought it was a bit of a mystery. She kept on having all these attacks. But now we've moved it on. We now know 12 years on, it's not a mystery, is it? WHO, 7 to 8 million people die every year through air pollution. And it's contributed to like respiratory illnesses, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So now you are one of the leaders in trying to push the message out.
I'm sure that
now you are talking about policy changes and looking towards the future all the time. And you bring up the WHO. So what policy changes do you think would have the biggest impact on preventing other families from experiencing what you did?
Well, the coroner addressed different people. Number one, he addressed the government and what the government needed to do, and they still haven't done it. They needed to make the air quality targets more stringent to be in line with WHO. There are very few countries that have actually done that. So the coroner's message is not just to the UK government. It could be to any government worldwide. The other thing the coroner said, there needs to be more monitoring, proper monitoring, but also tell people what they are breathing in. Then he admitted there needs to be raising awareness, because people, even now, people might know air pollution is bad. They still don't know how it's impacting their bodies. But one of the most important, significant decisions he made was to tackle people in health, no matter if you're a consultant of 40 years or you're just starting out as a medical student. He felt they needed to be taught more about asthma, allergies, and also air pollution, and the link between asthma especially and air pollution. And if you're studying as a medical student now, you do not get the privilege of saying, oh, we just covered that in one module and that. No, that should be a significant part of your training, because you will ultimately come across people who are impacted by air pollution. So that's what the coroner left us with. I have met every minister there possibly is. They know how much air pollution is impacting health. Governments spend trillions on healthcare. If they use some of that money to clean up the air, not as many people will get ill in the first place. They go on about economy and growth. Well, if you've got people ill from cancers, diabetes, obesity, strokes, low sperm count, preterm birth, there's now pollution, the particles, even in the placenta, even in old age, they've found on a dementia patient's brain the particular matter. So they pump trillions into this. So how about they use some of that money to clean up the air, and then we won't be suffering the way we are. But they don't seem to be getting that message.
Yeah, Rosamund, I want to leave the conversation with this. You know, you went through a truly, I mean, difficult, traumatic, life-changing experience here. You didn't want to be an anti-pollution campaigner beforehand. Now you spent so much of your time doing this work. What matters most to you now?
I think governments need to become clean. Look, let me tell them this. If not now or tomorrow, but at some point in the future, people will ask, you had all this information and you did nothing. So from going from an innocent mum, I've now found that the fossil fuel lobby want to keep this thing going. It's not sustainable. And people are now suffering. So I ask all governments, look at the amount of money you're spending on your healthcare and a fraction of that to clean up.
Rosamund Hadou Kissi Debra is founder of the Ella Roberta Foundation. Rosamund, thank you so much for coming on and spending time with us.
Thank you so much for having me. And please, your listeners who already know about air pollution and the impact it has on health, talk to your families about it. Talk to your friends about it. Please don't assume everybody knows about it, because they don't. And one day soon, clean air will become a human right.
Coming up, measuring the real impact of cars, trucks, and buses on air quality.
There are 5 million premature deaths every year from just the impact of ambient particulate matter and ozone globally anyway, and a large proportion of them come from transportation.
That's up next when Climate One continues.
Help others find our show by leaving us a review or a rating. Thanks for your support.
Kusha, do you remember Dieselgate?
Yes, I do. I recall Volkswagen cars that were polluting way more than they claimed to be during emission tests, right?
Yeah, it was an especially egregious case of emissions cheating, but certainly not the only one. Our next guest's organization works to evaluate real-world emissions from transportation and push for policies to reduce them, like shifting to electric vehicles. Sheila Watson is deputy director of the FIA Foundation, a UK-based charity committed to promoting safe, sustainable mobility across the world. Your foundation sponsored a recent study on the health benefits of better policies targeting road transport emissions. What are the top takeaways from that report?
The main takeaway from the work is just how very poisonous the emissions of road transportation vehicles are. And we know that there are 5 million premature deaths every year from just the impact of ambient particulate matter and ozone globally anyway, and that a large proportion of them, the WHO called it a significant and growing proportion, come from transportation. So we know the context is that there's a real problem. And the report basically showed how the development and use of a range of different policy tools could actually help to prevent many of the premature deaths, those 5 million premature deaths every year. The report suggests as many as 1.9 million premature deaths could be averted. And then, of course, not just early deaths, but sadly, childhood asthma is a direct result of those emissions. And so the report suggests that 1.4 million new cases of paediatric asthma could be prevented over a time period, 2023 to 2040. So it's a pretty significant issue. And the report suggests that it can be addressed. So in a sense, there's hope.
Yes, yes. Well, so let's talk about those policies. So this could not quite have, but significantly reduce the numbers of these premature deaths. So what are those policies? Is it switching to electric vehicles? Are there other aspects at play here?
Switching to electric vehicles, that's a big one, yes. And the report identifies that as possibly the lead impact. They identify 820,000 of those premature deaths averted just from the transition to electric vehicles. But I think importantly as well, they identify that when you layer policies, so you add other policies on together, you get a much stronger cumulative impact. And so issues like stricter emission standards, which are currently in play in different parts of the world, but could be made stricter, removing dirty vehicles from our roads altogether. So that's ideas like scrappage policies, where you perhaps pay to take away the dirtiest vehicles. Obviously, cleaning up our electricity grid, because we don't get the benefits of electrification of our vehicles unless our power is generated in a cleaner way. Yes. So those things all added together can have this extraordinary impact.
So your foundation aims to help cities meet World Health Organization guidelines for clean air. How many cities around the world are actually meeting those guidelines today?
Well, analysis has suggested that 99% of the world's population live in places where the WHO air quality guidelines are not being met. So that's basically all of us.
So nobody lives in a city that meets almost no
well,
one.
Well, it would suggest, wouldn't it? But also that out of our global cities, only 17% of them meet WHO air pollution guidelines. And the issue here is the distribution, of course, of the population in different places. And, you know, the impact is obviously very extreme in terms of premature deaths in cities in Southeast Asia and the Western Pacific and so on. But when it comes to those preventable childhood asthma cases, it also includes cities like LA, Seoul, and even New York. So it's not an other problem.
And we know that those burdens are not equally distributed either, that certain parts of cities like Los Angeles bear the brunt of that diesel pollution, those traffic corridors and so forth. Why is it so difficult to meet those standards?
It's a combination of things. Possibly that there is not enough understanding of how we do it. That is possibly true in certain places. There's a big issue about political will. These issues of air quality from vehicles are now very much captured within what I think we're all commonly terming a culture war. In other words, the feeling that the right to access and drive any vehicle at any point in any way any of us choose is now being seen as a sort of right, which politicians sometimes struggle with addressing and aren't always necessarily finding it easy to do. So there's a little bit there about political will. And actually, there are lots of people doing things in this area. There are cities which are forging ahead with electric buses like Bogota, with restrictions on emission zones like London and Paris and so on. So there are cities doing things, but it is a challenge, yes, as with so much of this work to address climate or air quality. It's a challenge.
Right, of course, yes. So we mentioned that air pollution is a global problem. Many of us, most of us, live in places with somewhat unhealthy air. But of course, there are places with much, much worse quality than others. And some of that has to do with the way people are able to live and what options they have available to them. So how do you do this kind of work in places where economic development is prioritized over air quality regulations?
Well, I think that the argument that economic development sits contrary to air quality challenges is perhaps quoted as if it is a reason and a sort of a definite contradiction. It isn't. I mean, you know, those health disbenefits that I mentioned earlier, those impacts are costing around $1 trillion a year. So if you have a very unhealthy population in your city, you're paying for it one way or the other through lower economic capacity, actually, because of the many days of sickness and so on that are caused by the diseases we're talking about. So, you know, there is an economic case for moving forward on this, which doesn't sit against economic development. But I accept your point. And it takes us back to what I said before. Sometimes it can feel like it's too hard to try and address these things in that context. One of the projects that we are part of, which we partner with the International Council on Clean Transportation on, is our TRUE initiative, which is our Real Urban Emissions Initiative. And the background to that is Dieselgate, the great scandal which showed that vehicles were not emitting in the real world what they were supposed to be emitting, according to lab testing. And that gap is real. It is, you know, causing its own level of problem in terms of ill health. So that gap, they reckon, has killed 16,000 people in the UK since Dieselgate. So that's a lot of people. And so we take that project into countries. We work with local authorities, often cities, to establish an understanding of what's happening on the road. So not just what they think is, but what is really happening. And then we work together to share expertise around what the policy options are. So we try to collaborate. It's all very positive. It's all intended to be sharing good practice.
Right. So just to clarify, the problem that Dieselgate sort of illuminated, this real world difference between what vehicles are actually putting out versus what they can do in a lab setting, that persists beyond that particular scandal. And it's not limited to Volkswagen, which was the main culprit in that particular case, right?
No, that's right. It's the 10-year anniversary, actually, this year of the Dieselgate issue. And things have got better in some ways, in some places, but not completely, because of so many vehicles that still exist on our roads, which are from that era. Vehicles don't just exist in a moment and disappear. Clearly, they're owned for a period of time and driven for a period of time. So yes, we were involved in a conversation around Dieselgate, which was really an attempt to say, how do we avoid this happening again? And that's where the TRUE initiative emerged. Because whether it be deliberate cheating of the tests, or whether it just be clever calibrating alongside those tests, the point is, at the end of the day, people really suffer. Real people really suffer. I mentioned that gap and the assessment of what that alone has cost in terms of health impacts. I mean, again, it's UK-based, the stat that I have, but it's 30,000 children with childhood asthma who wouldn't have had it if we'd been able to calibrate our standards and regulations to the actual emissions of vehicles. And you know, sometimes those emissions are many, many, many times over what they should be. They're not just slightly over. And there has actually begun in Europe in particular, a big legal pushback against a whole range of manufacturers about the fact that this gap exists. And actually the data that we produce through TRU, we have 4 million observations plus of vehicles on our roads all over the world, is part of that case. So yeah, using every means possible to try and put this right.
TRU again stands for the Real Urban Emissions Initiative.
The Real Urban Emissions Initiative, yes.
So the data is being used to bring cases against these car manufacturers, but how else is that data being used? Is it being used by regulators?
The data is available for anyone who would like to use it, actually. We're very, very keen that everyone with an interest in the issue uses it. So it's there for policymakers. So yes, the regulators or the, you know, the city officials, the government officials who might want to frame policies using it. It's there if manufacturers wanted to use it. They probably have their own versions, but we would certainly be very happy to collaborate. That's not something that has happened to date. It's also there for consumers, and that's a really important point. That, you know, every decision we take makes a difference. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why, you know, we're so keen that everyone start thinking about this and acting right now. It's about, you know, taking our decisions with the best information that we can have, because at the end of the day, we're believing what we're told when we go in to purchase or lease or hire a vehicle. And when we're told it's doing something and then it turns out it's not, that's something really of a betrayal, because a lot of people are trying to do the right thing.
I recently read how extreme heat can make air pollution even more deadly. How do you think about these interactions between climate disruption and air pollution?
Well, they're both stemming from the same thing when it comes to transportation, and that's the burning of fossil fuels. That's the core shared issue. And we know that in a variety of different ways, those issues are addressed in a similar way for transportation. So, for example, within Europe, there was a move towards diesel because it was felt it would deliver a CO2 benefit, a carbon benefit for climate. There were promises made about its air quality impact, which didn't materialize. And so it's actually had a really rather negative air quality impact. But yes, on your point to do with heat, there are also issues around black carbon, short-lived climate pollutants, which are in a sense a crossover issue. They're a kind of air quality issue, but they also push climate change. And black carbon is a hugely growing problem globally.
Right. We just had an episode on super pollutants. That is one of them.
Yeah, it is.
That accelerates warming for the time that they're in the atmosphere.
Absolutely, it does. And yes, and so one of the cities in which the Urban Emissions Initiative worked was Paris. And we knew that within the European standard and regulation, there was a sort of cutoff for emissions in terms of their regulation beyond, I think, 30 degrees. And then we tested in Paris and we found not only, yes, at 30 degrees, emissions went crazy. So yeah, whatever was on board the vehicles was allowing them to emit anything they liked when it got really hot. There wasn't a regulatory control.
30 degrees is something like 86 degrees Fahrenheit.
Forgive me, 86 Fahrenheit. Yeah, so it's a pretty hot day, you know, especially in a city where you feel the heat more, I think. But then what was really horrifying was when we looked, of course, all our days are getting very hot. I don't know where at the moment, if it's hot where you are, the UK is having a heat wave, Europe's having a huge heat wave. And there had been a 50%+ increase in the number of days that had been over 30 degrees in Paris, sort of in the last 30 years or so. And so it was very common now to have those hot days. And on those hot days, emissions were particularly high from the vehicles in the city. And so the health impacts were particularly harmful on those days. So heating is a major issue, both the fact of it, but also the fact it's being driven, at least in part, by transport's contribution to our air quality problem.
Mm-hmm. I live in southern Arizona, which is hot now, hot much of the year. And Phoenix in particular gets many ground level ozone warnings this time of year because of that combination of heat, air pollution combining and making the quality of the air really bad. So you mentioned culture wars earlier, and here in the U.S., talking about climate has been increasingly politically divisive. So perhaps talking about air pollution might be a way to find a more receptive audience. What do you think of that idea?
I think that has some merit, yes. I hate to in any sense concede that the many, many years that we've all spent working hard to show people what climate change is about should in any way be kind of abandoned. I think we would regret doing that, and I don't think we should do that. And I think what's interesting in some of the polling that we're seeing here, again, I have to say in Europe, is that although, you know, maybe some of the political class is worrying about this usage of this phrase, actually people have accepted a great deal of the evidence for climate change and don't feel quite so at ease with the idea we just now pretend it's not happening. So there is that. But having worked on climate change issues for many years, I've always adopted whatever argument or aspect of the issue worked best in the setting that I was in. So we know that, for example, with transportation, the climate issue sits alongside things like energy security. So if you want, you know, more efficient vehicles, that's saving you fuel. Yes, it's good for the climate. It's also saving you fuel. So it's good for your back pockets. So it's a prosperity issue and so on. So very often, in any case, we would use arguments in these debates which were more understandable or palatable to people with whom we were dealing. All that said and done, I do think air quality comes very close, as I said before, as an issue with CO2 and vehicles and having very common solutions. So if it works, then great. If people find it easier to understand, then great. But I don't think we should kid ourselves that it'll be easier. It may help with that bump around what you're describing in this sort of culture war, but I don't think that it means the solutions are any easier for us to press for and the change is any easier to get. It's still going to be a lot of hard work.
Absolutely. Yeah. Sheila Watson is Deputy Director of the FIA Foundation. Thank you so much for joining us on Climate One.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, why using other words to discuss climate disruption can bring more people on board to address it.
If you frame climate change as an environmental issue, then if you're not an environmentalist, you think it's not your issue. Most Americans don't consider themselves environmentalists.
That's up next when Climate One continues. We've been talking this hour about how harmful bad air quality is to human health, the health of all of us. And let's be frank, clean air is something most people can get behind. So maybe we should consider reframing climate disruption as an air pollution problem.
Susan Joy Hassel is director of Climate Communication, a nonprofit science and outreach project that's part of the Aspen Global Change Institute. She's contributed to the U.S. National Climate Assessments and is a leader in how to talk about climate disruption.
In an article she wrote for Scientific American called "The Right Words Are Crucial to Solving Climate Change," Hassel suggested alternatives to some of the main terms used in climate discussions. She explained this approach to Climate One's Austin Colon.
Climate change is a term that scientists use to mean any type of change in climate at any time in Earth's history for any reason. And so when people hear climate change, they think, well, that sounds natural, because there has in the past been natural climate change. What we're dealing with now is really human-caused climate disruption. That makes it more clear that this is not just that background kind of natural climate change. This is something that humans are doing. And I also don't like when people say it's caused by human activities, because I think that's very vague. So what are those activities? It's the burning of coal, oil, and gas and the destruction of forests. We have to be very clear about what the cause is, because we've known that for a long time.
Right. And I will say, though, I noticed that climate change is in the title of the article. So I'm curious whose choice that was or how that ended up there.
Yeah. So people still use the term climate change. And what I tell people is, if you're going to say climate change, just to make sure everyone knows what you're talking about, make sure you say human-caused climate change. On the other hand, because of how politicized this issue has become, if you say the term climate change, people react. As soon as they hear that term, they shut down. So maybe in some cases, it's better not to say those words and to talk about extreme weather and the disruption of our climate system and the kind of thing that's not going to trigger that immediate partisan reaction.
Right. You kind of have to meet people where they are oftentimes. Let's go to another phrase. How about greenhouse gas emissions? What do you think would be a better way to say that?
Yeah, so I call it climate pollution. People generally think of air pollution as something they can see and smell, like sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxides. Those are the pollutants that caused acid rain and urban smog. And we were able to put scrubbers on coal-fired power plants and do things to get rid of those, right? But the air pollutants that cause global heating are invisible. Carbon dioxide, methane, nitrous oxide, and the only way to stop emitting them is to stop burning coal, oil, and gas. And of course, we now have cleaner and better forms of energy that are also cheaper. So there's no reason not to make that transition from dirty energy to clean energy. So I think when you talk about greenhouse gas emissions, it's a sciencey sounding thing. And it kind of depends on people understanding the metaphor of the greenhouse effect.
Right.
So I tend to call it heat trapping pollution.
All right. That makes sense. Yeah, it really gets to the heart of exactly what's happening. One of them that you pointed out was my personal pet peeve, because I spend a lot of time with my family in South Florida, where they call, you know, this recurring flooding nuisance flooding. Like, I mean, it sounds like, you know, just something they can, oh, it's not a big deal. It's like swatting away a mosquito or something. What would you say is a better way to say nuisance flooding?
Yeah, I agree with you. This is not just a nuisance. When the streets of Miami are flooded, the water's up to your knees, businesses are closing, you know, all kinds of problems. It's way more than a nuisance. So I call it recurrent flooding or sunny day flooding, because this is stuff that happens even when it's not raining. Every time there's high tide, because of sea level rise, which is again caused by human-caused climate disruption, you've got a flood. So recurrent flooding or sunny day flooding. But yeah, we've got to get rid of that nuisance flooding.
And of course, that brings us to what people often call natural disasters. And that's probably a pet peeve of yours, too. Like, they don't seem very natural.
Yes, it's a big pet peeve of mine. I really don't like the term natural disasters, because these things are now decidedly unnatural. So I call them unnatural disasters. We've always had extreme weather, but now it's more extreme.
Right.
We're seeing more of the kinds of weather that cause these disasters. And so we shouldn't call them natural, because they're not natural. You know, similarly, people will say, oh, this is a new normal. And that bothers me, because that sort of normalizes it. And it also makes it sound like we've reached a new steady state, when in fact, it's much worse than that. It's going to keep getting worse until we stop emitting this heat-trapping pollution. So I like to say we're in a new abnormal, and it's going to keep changing and keep getting worse until we stop doing what's causing it.
Right. And to speak to that a little bit, you happen to live in Asheville, North Carolina, which was devastated by Hurricane Helene last year. And what was your personal experience with that storm?
Oh, it was really devastating for everyone here. Whole parts of town were underwater. You know, 100 people died. And so many people lost their homes. And in the parts of town that weren't flooded, like where I live, so many trees came down because the ground was already saturated from the days and days of rain. And then when those strong winds came, trees just came down with the big root balls up in the air. They crushed houses and cars and people. So it really was devastating to our power infrastructure, our water infrastructure. We didn't have power for about a month. We didn't have water for several months. And when you have to go stand in line and bring home a 5-gallon bucket of water for the day, it's a very different story than just, you know, a storm coming through. And of course, whoever thought in the mountains of Western North Carolina, we'd be hit by a hurricane? It's kind of crazy, right? And such heavy rainfall and such strong winds. Of course, our local economy has taken a huge hit, which continues to this day. 9 months on, we're still having issues with our infrastructure and with our economy.
Going beyond words, there are adjacent issues that resonate more universally that should be talked about, like talking about drought when talking to farmers. What do you think of that strategy?
I think it's essential. You have to talk to people about their priorities and what they care about. And you know, if you frame climate change as an environmental issue, then if you're not an environmentalist, you think it's not your issue. Most Americans don't consider themselves environmentalists. But right, for farmers, you talk about drought. For birders, you talk about what's happening to the birds. For people who fish, you talk about what's happening to our cold water trout streams. Climate change is affecting everything and everyone. And we need to really reframe it from an environmental issue or a science issue or a political issue to one that's about protecting who we love and what we love and the places that we love. So I feel like that's really essential. You know, climate change is affecting everyone, everything, everywhere, all at once. We all want, you know, right? We all want clean air, clean water, healthy forests and coasts. Everyone loves their kids. Climate change is affecting kids' health now, and it has long-term implications for their development. You know, our kids, they're living through ever-increasing unnatural disasters, leading to evacuations, school closures, and other things that really upend their lives. And, you know, more kids are suffering from allergies and asthma, and both of those are exacerbated by climate disruption. We're seeing kids hospitalized from heat stroke. That's a more important and, I think, a more impactful way to talk to people about climate change.
Yeah, but many climate solutions, like transitioning from fossil fuels, provide immediate air quality improvements and health benefits. How do we help people understand these co-benefits, you know, without making the message too complicated?
Yeah, well, I never use the term co-benefits. That sounds to me like something to do with health insurance.
It probably is.
So I like to say multiple benefits. There are so many benefits of clean energy. It's the things we want to be doing anyway, right? It cleans up our air and our water. We don't have to do mountaintop removal and wreck the mountain streams. It's also cheaper, right? So solar and wind are actually the cheapest form of new energy. Do you know that more than 90% of all the new electricity generation coming online in the U.S. is clean, renewable energy? And the reason for that is not because of climate laws, because in this country, we have none. And still, that's the cheapest form of energy, so that's why it's coming online.
One thing I always find fascinating is that, you know, climate disruption is not something that people often bring up in, you know, polite conversation, but weather almost always is. Frankly, it's often the first thing that people talk about. And we did an episode last year on how local TV meteorologists work climate into their weather reports. And there were people in a couple regions where the audiences were so hostile to the idea of climate disruption that station managers told the reporters to stop discussing it completely. One meteorologist even received death threats. What would your recommendation in that situation be? Like, how do you educate a hostile public?
It's a very difficult question, and it's the one that we've been dealing with for decades, just since this issue became so politicized. I've worked with the broadcast meteorologists, so I know about all that. I know the one that you're talking about that got the death threats and stuff. So it really is a major challenge. I think sometimes not saying the words climate change, but still having them incorporate talking about extreme weather and saying, okay, here we are, we're in the first heat wave of the summer. And did you know that a few decades ago, the United States saw an average of 2 heat waves in a summer? And now we see an average of 6 heat waves in a summer. So we are now suffering through 3 times the number of heat waves every summer. You don't have to say the words climate change, but you tell them this is what's happening. People have to experience the evidence of their own eyes, right? What they're feeling and experiencing. But you have to help them realize that this is not just summer. This is now a different story. Climate is changing, and we know what's causing those changes. So I think we do have to keep reminding people of what we're seeing and to put it in context. It's going to be really hot today. Do you want to see the graph of how many days over 100 we've had from 50 years ago till today, and you see that line going up everywhere?
Yeah.
I think people have a right to know the context in which they're living. But yes, it's still this hostile public problem. So I think the main thing is talking to people about who they care about and what they care about and how it's being affected by human-caused climate disruption. Not about polar bears, not about saving the planet. It's about saving ourselves and everything we love and care about.
Yeah, I mean, there's often a joke that I believe George Carlin told that, you know, the planet is going to be fine. We're the ones who are going to have the issue. I think he said it a little more colorfully than that, but you get the idea.
Absolutely. And I couldn't agree more. So I always tell people it's not about saving the earth. It's about saving ourselves. You know, Thoreau said, what's the use of a house if you haven't got a decent planet to put it on?
Right. So you focus on communicating both the urgency and agency of climate action. But how do you balance conveying the seriousness of climate threats while also empowering people to feel that they can make a difference?
Yeah, it's tricky because the urgency is tremendous. The issue of climate change is not like some other issues. If we don't get it done this year, we can get it done next year. We are in a critical period of time. We have to do as much as we can, as fast as we can. And the Inflation Reduction Act wasn't enough, but at least it got us moving in the right direction. What's happening now, to take away all of that good climate policy, it's going to make us sprinting in the wrong direction. And so there is tremendous urgency. Every day that we don't act, we commit to a more dangerous and hotter future. And I don't think that's what any of us want. So the urgency could not be greater. So I think it's really important for people to understand that we can do something about this. You know, everyone can take up the mantle. Talk to everyone you know about climate change in a way that will resonate with them and reach them personally. Especially talk to your elected leaders and business leaders and make sure they know that you care about this and you want to see them do the right thing. And then everything that we need to do about this is something we should be doing anyway, right? Who doesn't want cleaner energy, cleaner air, cleaner water, healthier, more walkable communities, sending fewer kids to the hospital with asthma attacks and heat stroke? Who doesn't want that?
Right, exactly. Do you think it's possible to depolarize climate disruption?
Once again, I think we have to go back to what people care about. If they say they care about America being great and America being strong in the world, then certainly they've got to see that competing in the global clean energy race is really important. So yeah. Do they care about national defense? The Pentagon's very concerned about climate change. They call it a threat multiplier. So if you care about our defense, if you care about our place economically in the world, whatever it is you care about, climate change is affecting that thing. So that's what we have to keep bringing it back to. And maybe sometimes not calling it climate change might be the right way. You know, most people like clean energy. The polls show that people really do like clean energy, even if they're not interested in climate change. You know, there are plenty of people who have electric cars and solar panels on their roofs who are still not on board with the reality of human-caused climate change. They're doing it because it saves money. You know, there are schools that have done it. The Kentucky Coal Museum covered its roof in solar panels.
Yes.
They did not do that because of climate change. They did it because it saved them money, thousands of dollars a year. So sometimes we find a side door, right? If the front door is locked, instead of banging your head against that locked front door, which will only give you a headache, I know from experience, find a side door.
Excellent. Well, I think we'll leave it there. Susan, thank you so much for this conversation. It's definitely going to make me think about the way I talk to people about climate disruption way more carefully.
Well, thanks. I'm glad we got this chance to talk about it because really the future is in our hands.
Hey, it's Ariana and Kusha and Greg, who's joining us to share one more thing as we do most weeks here on Climate One. So welcome, Greg. What is your Climate One more thing?
Hey, Ariana. Well, I returned from a family trip yesterday and flew into San Francisco Airport. And when I got on the air train that goes around the terminals, I was really excited to see a billboard that says, quote, simmering down emissions with all electric kitchens at airport restaurants. I was excited to see that. I never thought about airport kitchens before. We know that flying creates a lot of emissions and is harmful. And I'd never thought about the energy inside the airport before. And I reached out to the person who runs sustainability at SFO and said, yeah, all of our kitchens at the new Terminal 1 are electric. And I thought that was great.
Yeah, when you think about it, there must be so much energy put into food production at major airports like SFO. Do you feel like that's going to influence the way that you eat when you're at the airport, Greg?
Well, the cool thing is, well, I eat first for nutrition and diet, but then think about the energy used to make it. My favorite is the acai bowl place at that terminal, but it's nice to know that it's all electric. And as I was going around the air train, I saw a whole lot of solar panels, new solar panels being installed on the roof of the terminal. So that took electrification one more step. And I reflected on how airports are run by authorities that make decisions. So they can say, if you want to cook food at this airport, you have to use electric, et cetera. So they can really drive the behaviors of businesses and merchants coming in there.
Yeah, that's amazing. Also, I find it hilarious when you say that your first priority eating at an airport is health and nutrition. Because me, at least, I use the airport as an excuse to be like, oh, Twizzlers are now healthy because that's what's at the gift shop. So, Ariana, do you have something you want to share?
I do, actually. I signed up for a webinar this month with Rewiring America, which is a great organization. We've had them on the show before. They do a lot of education about electrification broadly. And this webinar is open to anyone. It's just a place to learn more about electrification in general. And so if this is something you're curious about, you want to know more about heat pumps or induction stoves, as well as kind of the broader conversation around electrification, this might be a good resource. So you could check it out, rewiringamerica.org.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening. You can see what our team is reading by subscribing to our newsletter. Sign up at climateone.org.
Climate One is a production of the Commonwealth Club. Our team includes Greg Dalton, Brad Marshland, Jenny Park, Austin Cologne, Megan Basilia, and Kusha Navadar. Our theme music is by George Young. I'm Ariana Brocious.